Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Paul Epworth.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome back to The First Time here on BBC Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved artists around and take an in-depth look at the pivotal musical moments that have made them who they are today. This week, I'm talking to a multi-award-winning musician, remixer, composer, and super producer who's worked with many of the world's biggest artists, from Adele to Florence and the Machine, from Bloc Party to Maxima Park, and from U2 to Sir Paul McCartney. He's won 3 Brits for Producer of the Year and across the pond has bagged a bunch of Grammys and an Oscar for Best Original Song for the James Bond theme Skyfall. Last year, he also released his first solo album, Voyager, an epic and cosmic collection of tracks, which includes collaborations with Vince Staples, Ty Dolla $ign, Cool Keith, J Electronica and Leanne LaHavas. I'm very pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is Paul Epworth. Paul may have once been Sir George Martin's T-boy, but he's now one of the most sought-after record producers and songwriters in the world. He's written for, produced and guided countless artists to success, and his credits include FKA Twigs, The Horrors, Friendly Fires, Beck, Rihanna, Glass Animals, Futureheads, Lana Del Rey, and he also co-wrote Adele's world-conquering Rolling in the Deep. Here in this interview, which was recorded at the end of last year, Paul talks about his early love of prog music and sci-fi soundtracks and his father's musical influences, all things that impacted on the sound of Voyager. We also discuss him discovering Fela Kuti and Fugazi and talk about how he gets the best out of artists in the studio. But I started by asking Paul, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
God, that's a tricky one. I've never actually sat and thought what was my first musical memory, but that's an incredible question. I do have this moment of remembering my dad playing me Dark Side of the Moon, and it's sort of blowing my mind a bit. My dad was into prog rock. My dad was into all sorts of stuff. My mum was into soul music. Memories of cassettes of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. I am yours, you are mine, you are what you are. You make it hard. And Yes, and Nilsson, and obviously the Beatles. My dad was a scientist, so he had these kind of weird Walter Carlos records. He was into his hi-fi, and so, like, I guess that he was always in the house, and there was Blondie and Kate Bush on TV, you know, and so I guess that, like, all these things fuse into a sort of ball of noise. I remember, like, memories of being maybe 3 or 4 and hearing the Pointer Sisters and Boney M on the radio in the car. I guess all these things are probably, you know, probably form into one sort of blur.
Interesting you said your dad was, like, into hi-fi. Was he one of those... Did you have the big wooden-sided speakers and lots of cables and silver knobs around the house?
Yeah, 70s hi-fi has a smell as well. It really... It's like, believe it or not, it has a certain smell. If you go into Audio Gold in Crouch End, you walk in and it sort of hits you, and it's like... It's incredibly nostalgic to me. It's the magic of being able to put on a record, and I probably did go sort of sit and go through his records, and, you know, I guess, it's only really kind of talking to you now that I realise probably what a formative experience that was in terms of sort of, you know, sending me off on the path of being a sort of sound engineer and later a producer. Like, I remember him building me a box of electronics for my birthday, which is obviously parts he'd cannibalised from various things, and he made bleeps and squelches, and I remember this the other day and sort of went, oh man, probably that one toy said, that's to blame for a very expensive synthesizer habit.
Soul music there. Marvin Gaye is someone who's hugely important to you. What is it about him that made such an impact on you?
Otis was the voice for me and Stax music. But you can't be in record production without looking at what's going on I think, in my opinion, it might be the greatest album ever made. I couldn't tell you it was my favourite album, but I think it's as a sort of start to finish journey of musical and studio mastery and the lyrical content and the strength of the songs and the emotional honesty and the it's a staggering piece of work, you know, and I think when you put it in context of, like, the sort of cultural shift at the time and the, you know, the social conversation and the musicianship and the arrangements, you know, like, you could probably do a thesis on that one album. And you probably touch on most genres of music, or the impact it's had on musical culture. It's just, I think, is impossible to ignore. When I sort of started on this journey of making a record of my own, and you begin to have to think about what makes a great album. You know, I was sort of a couple of years into the process of, like, grabbing bits of time here and there, and I was like, well, if I don't end up with any decent songs, what can I do to make this record really powerful? And I thought, well, why not just make it as one piece of music? And then I was sort of like, oh, I wonder what other albums have done this. And then, of course, you go back to What's Going On, which more or less plays as one piece of music. And there's no world in which you can... I would ever want to compare my little album to that masterpiece. for me, is what, you know, actually as a producer looking at the technical feats that they went through to do it, like I find it incomprehensible.
Hey baby, what you know good? I'm just getting back, but you knew I would. War is hell. When will it end? When will people start getting together again? Are things really getting better, like the newspapers said? What else is new, my friend, besides what I read? Can't find no work, can't find no job, my friend. Money is tighter than it's ever been. Say, man, I just don't understand what's going on across this land. Oh,
what's happening, brother?
Yeah, what's happening? What's happening, my man? Woo! Are they still getting down where we to go and dance? Will our ball club win the pennant? Do you think they have a chance? And tell me, friend, how the world have you been? Tell me what's up. I wanna know what's in. What's the deal, man? What's happening? What's happening, brother? What's happening? What's happening, brother? What's happening, brother? Say it, man. Woo! What's happening, brother? What's been shaking up and down the line? I know how I'm slightly behind the time.
What was the first piece of music that you bought for yourself? Not influenced by your parents, you went out and you got it, and you were like, this is mine, this is for me.
It was the Star Wars soundtrack.
I mean, that's the good, that's John Williams, I mean...
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I must have been about 5 or 6, you know, I loved Star Wars, but it wasn't my own money, but it was, you know, can I buy this record? And I remember going home and sticking it on the turntable and probably breaking my dad's stylus in the process.
What about your own money then?
You know, might have been quite random, actually.
It's all been pretty cool so far, so it can be embarrassing. No, it's all right.
What was it? Like, I'm trying to think what it was. You know what? I went out with my own money and I bought Street Sounds Electro 8 compilation on cassette. That was it. And I think I was 11. I remember for the first time of actually feeling like that was my own music. It felt like it was so disconnected to anything I'd grown up on. If you're in your sort of mid-40s, you can't avoid being a child of the electro soul generation.
My name is Mosty, as you already know. Oh, what's up? A Sparky D, are you running the show? You left me a Slim around the way, and that's why I'm here this very day. A Mosty is in the place, most definitely. I'm a sure shot, better be a fly MC. I know you made a record and you said our names, but as far as I'm concerned, things not the same. Oh, friend, I have a beef. You're not the only female who's rocking the street. That's right, Mosty, I'm not going to fest, but I'm the biggest, the baddest among the rest. I didn't leave you and City Slim out, but being that you're beefing, you should shut your mouth. You know I'm still down with the Playgirl crew. I just did what I had to do. If they wanted you a Slim, you would have found out. But they picked Sparky D, cause I got the clout. I tell you, my girl and anybody else, Sparky D is in this world, and I'm going for self.
I think I spent a whole year just with that in my boombox.
First gig, another big obvious one's here, the first time you went to go and see something on stage.
My first gig, I think my dad took me to go and see Peter Gabriel at Earl's Court on the So Tour.
Get off, that's a great tour to see.
Yeah, yeah, and looking back, he went quite far in terms of, I think I remember him falling off stage with in the Jesus Christ pose.
Yeah.
And falling onto the crowd. The punk that I became in later years, but looks back on that, it was quite cynical about it, but my old man was quite into his prog rock, so having sort of grown up on plenty of Genesis, the album So was quite, you know, with the kind of, I think it was a Landwehr production, wasn't it?
Mm.
But yeah, it's like, I think it's kind of stood the test of time.
You mentioned punk there, so I think let's touch on Gang of Four. That's the flip side, I guess, of the Gabriel.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the things I discovered. I discovered later. For me, though, that sort of post-punk stuff was super nostalgic from remembering being a kid. I guess it was nostalgic about where the world was when I was about 4, 5, 6 and discovering music. But I guess, you know, it's like the sort of civil unrest at the time and, the sort of railing against the kind of trials of the Thatcher years. And when I sort of discovered all these albums a little bit later in my life, like Gang of Four, Pop Groups, Why, you know, amongst sort of many other sort of, you know, things like the Au Pairs and Maximum Joy and Rip Rig and Panic and all these other things, which I kind of, I went through a whole, you know, I always tend to go through musical phases of kind of really sort of mining one era or one sort of genre of music and just trying to find out what I can about it. But particularly Gang of Four, Entertainment was for me such a sort of pivotal discovery. As a guitarist, it was such an amazingly sort of brutal sound that Andy Gill made. I was like, I need to form a band that sounds like this. I think everyone in Shoreditch around the same time had the same idea.
Let's talk about Fugazi. Was it just the music or was it the whole ethos?
No, I mean, yeah, definitely. It's kind of being like 17 or 18. I saw Nirvana's first show at the Astoria. They were first on the bill. So having been through all the kind of sort of the grunge phase and then sort of and Sonic Youth, and to discover this band that was like, I mean, kind of, I guess, I think to everybody, Fugazi feels like your own band. You know, they're like, there's a sense of possessiveness about the fact that, like, their sort of stoic independence and the kind of abstract politicism of the lyrics. It's only in hindsight now I kind of see how much of a sense of humour they had as well. Of all the bands that I've loved over the years, I think they're probably the one I've listened to the most. And it's only recently I found out how big the studio was that they actually recorded those records in and what the sort of creative restrictions were. And it's like, I was quite astonished. Amazing sounding records, but I guess kind of the whole DIY thing, you know, to have that kind of sort of sense of independence and be able to put out records by artists you love and do deals that were fair unfortunately, the industry is not heading in that direction. It's heading away from it.
It's true.
They should be an inspiration to all. Thanks, Ian.
I am a patient boy. I wait. My time to want to sell a train. Everybody move. Please don't need me to remain. Live away from the nerve. Stand outside of town. Everybody's always down. Because they can't get up.
They want to get up. Come on, get up.
Do another influence. Let's talk about Fela Kuti. When did Fela first come into your life?
So I remember the exact moment. I was in a cab on the way back from a very late studio session, and I used to have this habit of I'd always get in the car and ask the driver. The drivers would always turn off the radio, and I was like, no, put the radio on. You know, put the cassette back in that you were listening to, because I knew I'd always discover new music. And every time, you know, I'd stumble on stuff. And one day I got on this very late cab journey and I was like, no, mate, just put your cassette back in. And he's like, you sure? And I was like, yes. And he popped it in and I just went... I don't think I slept that night because I just said this 20-minute journey back and it was one piece of music. And I was fortunate enough as a kid to have some sort of African music in the house, you know, things like the Bundu Boys and, you know, like, and I think in the 80s, obviously Ladysmith Black Mambazo was one of those things that... off the back of Paul Simon that plenty of people went out and bought those albums. But really discovering Fela and how important he was sort of culturally, politically, trying to get my brain around the intricacies of the music was really a huge moment for me in my early 20s. You can hear things that have been influenced by it, things like Talking Heads, Remaining Light, you know, and Eno around the same time he was making records in Ghana. In this little studio in Accra, and so he'd sort of gone back with his sort of knowledge of the kind of complexities of the rhythms and the intricacies of the way the guitars work together, and lots of tiny elements working together to form this beautiful kind of sort of tapestry of music and rhythm. You never, ever, ever get bored of him.
Da 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 gentle woman at all, oh. I no be gentle woman at all, at all.
I no be gentle woman at all, oh.
I be Africa man, original.
I no be gentle woman at all, oh.
I be Africa man, original.
I no be gentle woman at all, oh.
Them call you, make you con chop. You chop small. You say you belly full. You say you be gentleman. You go hungry. You go suffer. You go quench. Me, I no be gentleman like that.
I no be gentleman at all.
I be Africa man, original.
I no be gentleman at all.
I be Africa man, original.
And I be gentleman at all.
I be Africa man, original.
And I be gentleman at all.
You dey go your way, the judge way. Somebody come bring original trouble. You no talk, you no act. You say you be gentleman. You go suffer, you go tire, you go quench. Me, I no be gentleman like that.
I no be gentleman at all.
I be Africa man, original.
I no be gentleman at all.
I be Africa man, original.
I no be gentleman at all.
Africa hot, I like I'm so. I know what who we are, but my friends don't know. He put in socks, he put in shoe, he put in pant, he put in singlet, he put in trouser, he put in shirt, he put in tie, he put in coat, he come cover all with him heart.
That was Gentleman by Fela Kuti, the choice of my guest on the first time this week, Mr. Paul Epworth. And we'll have more from my chat with Paul, all coming up after the Six Music News.
Music.
This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. This is Anthony Birchley. Nazneen Zaghari Ratcliffe, the British-Iranian woman detained in Iran for 5 years for spying, has been released from house arrest. However, a new date has been set for her to appear in court regarding a separate case. The Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, welcomed the news but accused Iran of continuing to put her and her family through a cruel and intolerable ordeal. Tulip Sadiq is Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe's MP.
She has had her ankle tag removed, which was her tracker, and it meant that she couldn't really leave her parents' house, where she's been for the last year under house arrest. However, the bad news, I suppose, is that she has to go back to court next week, and we don't know what awaits there.
The Prime Minister has defended the 1% pay increase being recommended for NHS workers in England, saying ministers had tried to give as much as they could. Unions and bodies representing health trusts have said ministers should honour a rise of more than 2%, which was suggested in 2019. Speaking on a visit to a vaccination centre in Brent in North London, Boris Johnson said he was massively grateful to all health service staff.
The independent pay review body will obviously look at what we've proposed and come back. Don't forget that there has been a public sector pay freeze. We're in a pretty tough times. We've tried to give the NHS as much as we possibly can.
The Education Secretary Gavin Williamson says a range of measures are being considered to help school pupils in England catch up. Among the options being looked at to help make up for lost learning are a five-term year and a longer school day. More than 20,000 earthquakes have hit Iceland over the past week. The surge of activity has led some scientists to believe a volcanic eruption could be on its way. And Pope Francis has urged Iraqis not to lose hope. He was speaking during a prayer service in the north of the country on day three of his visit to Iraq. That's Six Music News. Your next update is at 2:30.
Six. For radio, music and podcasts, get Six Music on the BBC Sounds app.
Six Music.
Six Music.
The bump on your wrist you were born with.
you can. Watching you trying to push away. It hurts when you see it coming. Never use your words to show you care. I think you know it. Start to pick at the rips in my Nikes. You quote Tom York and lean in for a quick kiss, but still you just won't admit that you like me. Watching you lower both your eyes, it hurts when you know it's over. Still too stubborn to show that you can.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to The First Time, and my guest this week is award-winning record producer Paul Epworth. And you just heard Arlo Parks with Too Good, co-written and produced by Paul for Arlo's recently released debut album Collapsed in Sunbeams. And coming up we'll hear all about Paul's experiences working with Bloc Party and Florence and Adele. But before the big names, Paul was a guitarist with a band who just wanted to make their recordings sound better. Here he is on his first steps into making and producing music. What was your first band like, your very first band?
First band, we were called Headswell. I didn't come up with a name. And the rest of the band were amazing. I was dreadful. I literally couldn't write a song, didn't know what genre we wanted to be. We were sort of psychedelic shoegaze metal, clearly never going anywhere. The rest of the band, if they'd had a decent singer and a decent songwriter, they might have been huge.
So when did the switch to, like, I know what I want to hear, but I can't play it, so I'm going to help people get to that point?
We went into this kind of rehearsal room and thought they'd set up the mics, and then you could record the sound of the live band to cassette to see what you sounded like. And so we did that and sort of hit record on the cassette, and we all played with everything mic'd up, and we'd like, so it doesn't sound like a record. And they were like, oh, well, they've got a recording studio in the same building, so let's go into a recording studio and do proper recording. So we sort of, we saved up our pocket money, and, I think I was about 17 at the time. And we went to the studio and we kind of paid like 300 quid for two night sessions. And we thought, right, we're going to record the demo that's going to get us signed. And we sort of, spent ages in the engineer over two nights, recorded four tracks, mixed it. Sounded exactly the same as the cassette. And I was like, what's the difference between recording on cassette and recording in a studio if it sounds exactly the same? And it must be production. And the light bulb went on. So then we saved up another load of pocket money and went to another studio with the guy Ant, who turned us on to Gang of Four, who was actually a great producer. He was in Collapsed Lung. But this time I came in with loads of ideas. And I brought in some percussion, and I knew that we wanted to use a sample from Easy Rider here, and I had a tabla and a tambourine, and it sounded a little bit more like a recording, like a record, than either the previous things did. And I was like, oh, cool, so maybe I should go and Maybe if I went and did a course in sound engineering, I can actually learn how to do that for myself without having to put my friend Ant through the pain of having to sit in the studio with me for 2 days. And so, yeah, and that's what I did.
I was going to say, it's interesting because I think your generation, there's that point where you're sort of half the analogue and the old school stuff, but also on the cusp of, like, the new technology. So you kind of got, it would appear, you've got the best of both worlds, which is something that I think still happens in your work. There's both of those things.
Yeah, that's very astute of you. And I think I definitely came from an era of, I worked at Air Studios, at George Martin's studio over in Hampstead when I was, I think I must have been about 19, 20. I'd already been engineering for a couple of years before that in Harlow Square. And it was all tape machines. But I also knew that I needed to learn the sort of digital side of things to be able to make modern records. And I definitely got the two worlds, you know, like I love analog, but the only reason I'm a producer is because I was fortunate enough to be able to have a laptop to play around with, and you can kind of make up for the sort of these deficiencies in your own playing.
Let's talk about Block Party. They were such a big deal at the time, but now with hindsight, I think they were even more important than people realised, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely.
It was like they really did shift things enormously.
Yeah, the real combination of elements, that band, you know. When they put out their first EP, we shared a press agent. I put out an album with my band Lomax, and I think the first time I met them, where they came to our album launch, and so we got talking about music, and then about, you know, maybe like a year later, I'd finally got my production thing going. And so we met again, and I think without that first meeting, I think sort of just chance meeting, we may not have worked together. The very first thing we did was Banquet. I'd just done the Future Heads, and so I finally got my foot in the door after sort of knocking on it for a long time and nobody answering. So having just sort of done a few tracks with them and then got to do Banquet, but Banquet was really such a real key moment for me, because we went and sort of recorded it in this little studio in Camden, and then I took the stuff home and I basically back bedroom of this flat in Chiswick, and I sort of did all the production and mixed it in there. And one of the things that I had then was time to sit and really craft it. The sort of love and attention that you put into something when you're early in your career, because you're hungry and you don't have other distractions. I listen to that record and I can hear that energy and enthusiasm. But I think that comes from the band as well, you know, primarily. There's this kind of really youthful vibrance. And also, like, there was such a mad mash of influences. Like, I talked about the Gang of Four thing, but there was also this slightly sort of atmospheric shoegazy thing and sort of slightly Sonic Youth influence with some of the guitars. But somehow they made it all their own, and it's just, you know, they're quite a unique band, weren't they?
We'll be right back.
What was your first impressions of Florence?
I saw a show she did at Bush Hall, and it was so chaotic. And she had mascara down her face, and I just remember going like, "This is like Susie Sue. It's like Spellbound, it's like something from Kissing the Dream House." And like the thing is, I was really into those records at that point. But like every producer would love to stumble on a sort of new Kate Bush or Susie Sue just at that point when they're making their first album. I mean, people dream of falling into that moment. And I remember being at Bush Hall watching the show and going, right, okay. This is exciting. But then when you get in the room with her and she's really softly spoken and really very, very sweet, and there's a real dichotomy with her. I think those two things, when you push them together, make something really magical. Some of these vocal performances she did, like she'd reduce everyone in the room to tears. It felt like she was plugging into some spiritual force.
Some artists, some producers have got one of those songs, and you've got Rolling in the Deep, and that seemed to be a song that changed everything. And I wondered how you felt about that. Like, all of a sudden, you're kind of thrown into a very different world. And I just wondered how you felt about that, if you enjoyed it, if it was a bit scary to be like, all right, everyone's looking at everything she's doing and everything I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily need that right now because I want to get on with my work.
Yeah, no, it's very strange. I mean, the maddest thing was that it felt like it was overnight, but at the same time, it was like a sort of a 9-month process of this song sort of creeping up on us. And I mean, I guess the first inklings I had was when I, you know, always kind of, you know, seeing friends and they go, "What are you working on?" And you play them a tune, and then I remember playing that. Every time I played that to people, their jaws hit the floor. You know, and this was way before it came out, and so I knew there was something about that track that was definitely going to impact people.
Yeah.
I never imagined that song would do what it did. I never imagined I'd have a moment in my career that did what that song did, and I still feel kind of mildly baffled by the whole thing.
Did you enjoy it, though? Did you enjoy that experience?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, like, nobody sets out on a path going, I want to go and win awards, and because otherwise you're doing it for the wrong reasons. You want to be on X Factor if you're, like, maybe you wouldn't win awards if you're on X Factor, but, you know, it's just one of those things. But I love music, and I've always set out to just try and make the most adventurous music I can that is emotionally powerful, and that's always been the agenda. Everything else is fluff. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, like, it's just very weird. The biggest head scratcher about the whole thing was that we, you know, initially Rick Rubin was due to, was you know, Rick Rubin obviously did most of the record with them, and there was something about the demo that was unrepeatable. You know, we did this demo together, and it was a songwriting demo, so that we could, we sat down. So it's the one and only time in my career I've actually, someone said, "Go and write a song. Don't worry about the production. Just go and, you know, it's just got to be a song." So we just crafted it in about five to ten minutes, and, you know, basics of the song. And then, you know, she did these amazing vocals and structured it, and off it went. And about 6 months later, she went, "Can I put the demo out?" I went, "No, let me finish it. You know, let me just sort of polish it up a bit." And so really, it was, you know, like, even though that I'm a producer, the biggest song I've ever done was something I didn't really produce. I just sort of finished it.
Let's talk about Miles Davis.
Yeah.
So if you've got, like, this sort of very eclectic background when you were a kid, and there's the kind of prog stuff happening, and there's also the punk rock, because Miles's punk in many ways, if not sonically, certainly in attitude. Is there a key kind of record of that whole
world? You know, you can't really avoid Bitches Brew, can you? You know, it's I mean, especially in context of having made this record of mine, which is a kind of sort of cosmic space jazz kind of, you know, like... For me, the record that I really obsessed over of Miles was Silent Way. It was a time when I was listening to, you know, I just discovered sort of Herbie Hancock and Nobu and Sexton, and I was listening to loads of Can and Noi and Tangerine Dream, and somehow that Silent Way seemed to fit in with all those things as well, in its kind of meditative ambience. That album's a kind of like an anomaly. You know, it's definitely in my top 10 favourite records of all time. Can't really escape his influence on everything, really.
What did you learn from doing Voyager then? What did you learn about yourself? Can you produce yourself really? Can you take a step aside and just go, that's not the right thing, stop doing that?
No, the key thing I really learned, I think, was how hard it's been for the artists that I've worked with to be artists. All the stuff that goes on outside of making the music.
Right, okay.
Which is like, what do you want to write about? What do you want to make your music about? What is it you want to say? How do you want to say it? What language are you going to do it in? You know, and I mean, musically, creatively, or even linguistically. If you're trying to find these answers to those questions of like, what is it you want to say? You have to go inside, and the process of going inside, it's like, you know, you have to open some cupboard doors, which are like, you know, like, oh god, I don't like the look of it in there, and that's a challenging process. So you have to go through. There's a psychological side of it. You know, you have to go and try and work out how to make the music something that's truthful and honest. And if you're going to do that, it requires self-examination. I'm in the studio all the time with people going through that, and I've never cut them slack. I've always just... Because I've got a job to do, and my job's important.
That was rubbish. Do it again.
Yeah, you know, but there is a whole side to my job, which is like... No, it's not a job. I don't do a proper job, you know. I'm fortunate enough to be with great musicians and great artists and great singers, and my role is to get the best out of them. And sometimes getting the best out of them is pushing them, and it's finding out what makes them tick, and it's finding out what buttons you don't push and finding out what buttons you do push. Sometimes you've got to be kind and sensitive, and sometimes you have to go like, look, it's just not good enough. And it's different for every single person you work with, you know. And then there's the side which is like, some people just want me to sit at the back of the room and go, yes, good, bad, good, bad, good, bad, good, bad. And some people want me to actually get in and get on a computer and make, so essentially build the whole track, or sit on acoustic guitar. So that's really the major thrill of doing it, is that it's not like the routine repetition. And I couldn't do that. And that's one of the reasons that I kind of quickly jumped off doing guitar records. Because I was like, oh no, I'm going to be the guy that gets stuck in doing guitar records the rest of my life and I'll get bored. I think coming to Voyager, I was like, well, what things do I want to explore? And what, you know, like, and then I was like, well, I need a concept for this. I need something to, so where do I start? It's like, before you start that process of self-examination, you just go, I've got to have to say something. I'm not heartbroken, just about pay the bills. You know what I mean? If you're going to be real about it. So let's make a record about space. And then suddenly all the things about my own experience of it, be it spiritual, be it musical, be it scientific, you know, astronomical, you know, and then suddenly, like, you realise how many artists over the years have been influenced. They've made sort of cosmologically influenced music. And then you can suddenly see this, there's this almost a sort of slightly prismatic effect. You can see the common threads that all these things hung together, and then that sort of meant the musical palette gradually got smaller and smaller. You need restrictions. So you began to come into focus a bit. And so I set off on this journey, and the journey was challenging and it was immensely enjoyable. You know, there's a spiritual component to it. We're all voyagers. We're all on our own journeys, and our journeys are solo. And, you know, whatever's going on around us, we always, whether we're aware of it or not, we all have this very sort of, we have to have a singular relationship with ourselves. simultaneously self-deprecating and inwards. We have to have time to reflect, and I think it's funny putting out this album when everybody's had a moment of reflection globally. Like I said, I had to go and ask myself some questions about my own identity, and then through the process of making it, obviously my father passed away. And so many of these records were connected to going back to sort of the truth of what were the things that influenced my musical journey from being a kid. In a way, it was quite profound that this story loops in on itself in a very strange way. And that what I learned from the experience is that time becomes a loop. There have been so many moments of profound synchronicity in making the record that it's actually deepened my sort of abstract spiritual understanding of the universe, without wanting to go too deep. And I had some incredible fun making it.
Ask people to choose the final song that we'll play on the show.
I think I'd like you to play Flying Lotus, Do the Astral Plane.
Why that song?
Because I think that record Cosmogramma, it was a sort of profound influence, and it opened all these other journeys for me, things like Robert Glasper and Alice Coltrane and going back to Dilla Records, and you know, I don't know, it's just that record happened to me just at the right time. It was just what I needed, and there was a huge amount of that inspired Voyager. But that one song, there's something so sort of joyous and celebratory about it. It's a go-to if I want to have one of those moments of, like, hands in the air and still feel connected with the universe.
Then that's the song we'll finish on. Thanks, man. Good to speak to
you.
Yeah,
man, pleasure. Lovely to chat with you.
That was Flying Lotus and Do the Astral Plane. The final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Paul Epworth. If you enjoyed the show, search for The First Time in the BBC Sounds app to find more episodes from the archive. Up next on Six Music, Loyal Kana is in for Guy Garvey, and I'll be back next Sunday from 1 p.m. for another First Time, and I'll be talking to the incredible Laurie Anderson. I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Six Music.
This
is BBC Radio
Six Music.
Right now, it's Loyal Kana.